Every so often, a book becomes a cultural phenomenon. Sybil was one such book. It was published in 1973, billed as the true story of a woman who suffered from multiple personality disorder. It was a huge bestseller and became a popular TV movie. Now a new book, called Sybil Exposed, reveals an even stranger story of the real Sybil. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
When Sybil first came out, it not only shot to the top of the bestseller lists, it also spawned a psychiatric phenomenon. Within a few years of its publication, reported cases of multiple personality disorder leapt from less than 100 to thousands. But, says writer Debbie Nathan, most of the story is based on a lie.
Shirley started acting like she had a lot of people inside her.
Shirley is Shirley Mason, the real Sybil. She grew up in the Midwest in a strict Seventh-day Adventist family. An emotionally needy young woman, she decided to seek psychiatric help. Shirley became unusually attached to her psychiatrist, Dr. Connie Wilbur, and she knew that Dr. Wilbur had a special interest in multiple personality disorder.
And Shirley feels, after a short time, that she's not really getting the attention she needs from Dr. Wilbur. One day she walks into Dr. Wilbur's office and she says, "I'm not Shirley, I'm Peggy." And she says this in a childish voice.
Dr. Wilbur believed she had stumbled on a remarkable case. She began seeing Shirley frequently and eventually teamed up with the writer Flora Schreiber to work on a book about her patient. The two women taped a series of interviews. In this excerpt, Dr. Wilbur describes the moment that Peggy first appeared. She uses the pseudonym Sylvia to protect Shirley's identity.
She said, "I'm Peggy." And she proceeded to tell me about herself, that Sylvia couldn't stand up for herself and she had to stand up for her. Sylvia couldn't get angry because her mother wouldn't let her, but she got angry. She knew it was a sin to get angry, but people got angry, so she got angry.
Shirley became increasingly dependent on Dr. Wilbur for emotional and even financial support. She was eager to give her psychiatrist what she wanted.
Once she got this diagnosis, she started generating more and more personality. She had babies, she had little boys, she had teenage girls. She wasn't faking. I think a better way to talk about what Shirley was doing was that she was acceding to a demand that she have this problem.
Dr. Wilbur began injecting Shirley regularly with sodium pentothal, which was then being used to help people remember traumatic events that they had repressed. Under the influence of drugs and hypnosis, the very suggestible Shirley uncovered her many personalities. In this excerpt from a recording of one session, Dr. Wilbur talks to Shirley about a new personality who has surfaced.
"What's your name?"
"I'm Shirley."
She said her name is Shirley. And she said it about my grandma and...
"And no, she said it was her grandma and her mother."
"Mm-hmm. Is this another part of you, sweetie?"
"I'm thinking about it. It feels like it sort of..."
"Yeah, it feels like it's sort of another part of you."
Reading through Flora Schreiber's papers, Nathan says, it becomes obvious that the writer knew that Shirley's story was not entirely true. Memories of a traumatic tonsillectomy, for instance, morphed into a lurid story of abuse. And Schreiber seemed eager to pump up or even create drama where none existed. If Schreiber had doubts, she suppressed them.
She already had a contract and she already had a deadline. She was in the middle of writing the book. So she had sort of the dilemma that, you know, all journalists have nightmares about. What if my thesis turns out to be wrong as I do my research, but it's too late?
At one point, Shirley tried to set things straight. She wrote a letter to Dr. Wilbur admitting that she had been lying. "I do not really have multiple personalities," she wrote. "I do not even have a double. I am all of them." Dr. Wilbur dismissed the letter as Shirley's attempt to avoid going deeper in her therapy. By now, says Nathan, Dr. Wilbur was too heavily invested in her patient to let her go.
She had already started giving presentations about this case. She was planning a book. She was very, very attached to the case emotionally and professionally, and I don't think she could give it up.
And what about Shirley?
She got the very, very strong impression when she went in and brought this letter of recantation to Dr. Wilbur that if she didn't go with the program, she was not going to have Dr. Wilbur anymore. And Dr. Wilbur was giving her 14, 18 hours of therapy a week. So how could you give up Dr. Wilbur?
The book succeeded beyond anyone's expectations, selling some 6 million copies around the world, and was made into a TV movie starring Sally Field. As that movie draws to a close, Joanne Woodward, as Dr. Wilbur, describes a happy ending for Sybil.
Today, Sybil lives peacefully in a small college town where she's a professor of art. There's not enough time in the day for her to do everything she wants, but that time, in every sense, is her own. She tells me she's happy. I know she's free.
Shirley Mason almost had that life, but when Sybil came out and people began to suspect it was her, she fled, moving to a home near Dr. Wilbur, living in her shadow, and dependent on her psychiatrist until the end of her life. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And today our series, Two Languages, Many Voices, focuses on very young Latinas, girls who are likely to be reading the novels of Malene Alegría. Alegría's characters find themselves coping with everything from a really bad quinceañera, that all-important 15th birthday party, to illegal immigration. The characters in Alegría's novels must navigate two cultures, as do many of her readers. Nishat Kirwa of Turnstile News reports.
At schools in small Texas border towns like McAllen and Farr, Malene Alegría gets a rock star's welcome. An uncommon experience for an author who's not, say, J.K. Rowling. She's greeted by handmade posters and her name on the school marquees. All this grassroots love hasn't wavered in the years since the release of her first novel, Estrellas Quinceañera.
You can call yourself anything you want. Americana, Chicana, Latina, whatever. Your roots don't change. It's our blood. I tried to keep from rolling my eyes. You see, I think I've heard this speech about a million times before. Can't we just compromise?
That's from a video Alegría made. In Latino-majority regions around the U.S., she reads before auditoriums packed with teens.
I would dress up in the quinceañera dress. I would act out the characters and make it come alive for audiences. So I got a reputation amongst librarians and teachers that I was a good performer and I was really good at connecting with kids.
Nora Galvan is the library coordinator for a South Texas district that's about 98% Latino. She says most of her students are bilingual and hungry for stories like Alegría's.
The way she writes is the way we speak in this area. We do Spanglish all the time. I mean, every other word is Spanish, English, Spanish, English.
Some of Alegría's chapters open with glossaries. With a wink, they introduce words and phrases that are common to bilingual kids like Amanda Ceballos, a 13-year-old fan in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Like chola, the definition was like big hair and like hoop earrings and stuff, which is kind of true. I just never find that in a book, so it's pretty cool.
It's really beautiful to see the kids get excited about your work.
And Alegría says she gets plenty of letters from parents, too.
This was the first book my daughter read. Or this is the first book that my daughter and I can read together and talk about the issues that are in the book. And those, you know, it's just like, I could die right now and be happy.
For some of the isolated communities that Alegría visits, say in North Carolina or Illinois, Latino role models aren't so easy to come by. When she was a teenager herself, there were few estrellas on the teen fiction shelf. The characters that reigned supreme for girls back then were the alpha blondes of the fiction series Sweet Valley High.
I really believed that that is what American life is like, having blonde hair, having a twin sister, having a cute boyfriend with a red convertible, and thinking to myself that I needed to have this experience to be an American.
Alegría says as a kid growing up in the diverse San Francisco of the 1980s, her parents soaked her in indigenous culture. But junior high did a number on all that raza pride.
I was embarrassed of living in the Mission District and I used to lie about where I lived. Growing up feeling too dark for the boys to like, or my clothes were not new enough. So all of these insecurities are what I use in my writing now to educate and affirm for young kids that it's okay to shop at the flea market, have parents who are working class, and to be dark skin and still love yourself.
Now, Alegria will have a shot at rewriting the American experience for teens. Scholastic Books, the biggest publisher in young adult fiction, has commissioned her to write a new four-book series. In fact, she says it's pretty similar to Sweet Valley High.
But with brown kids.
The first book in Malin Alegria's new series is expected to come out next spring. For NPR News, I'm Nishat Kirwa.
Nishat Kirwa is a reporter for TurnstileNews.com, a project of Youth Radio.
The Occupy Wall Street protests that have spread across the country and around the world have taken up many different causes, but the protests share some common themes, including the gap between the rich and the poor. Once you adjust for inflation, the median income in this country has stagnated for about 38 years, almost two generations, even as people at the top have grown wealthier. In a book called The Price of Civilization, the economist Jeffrey Sachs critiques that gap.
It means that for the typical young person right now who is a high school graduate but on average will not get a bachelor's degree, life is extremely challenging to find a foothold with a stable job, with an opportunity to have a reliable income, health and other benefits, and a chance to have the kind of middle-class life that we once took for granted.
Jeffrey Sachs argues that tax cuts have mainly helped the wealthy, while cutbacks in government investments have harmed the economy, made the U.S. less competitive. He says he wants to shift money away from defense spending into things like roads and schools. It is a liberal critique of U.S. policies, though Sachs also thinks proposals like President Obama's jobs plan are just short-term fixes.
I'm emphasizing a point that was very well known and well appreciated in the boom times of America in the 1950s and 1960s, that an effective society, one that is highly productive, one that is inclusive with the broad middle class, and one that is environmentally sustainable, needs, of course, a market economy as its engine of development, but it needs an effective government as well. If we're going to have a society that is fair between rich and poor, we can't leave vast parts of our society to suffer in a poverty trap where young people grow up poor and then don't have the means to make it into the middle class because they can't meet college tuition, for example.
I want to ask about a criticism of your book that was printed in the Wall Street Journal. It was a review of the book, really, by Congressman Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin. He frames your book as having a completely different view of the role of government than he does. He describes your book. I want you to have an opportunity to respond to it. He describes you as saying that for people to be happy, their government must increasingly shield them from the challenges of life. Is that your view of government?
No, it's not my view of government. My view of government is that government helps to empower us as productive individuals, as healthy people, as well-educated people, businesses that can be competitive internationally, and it helps to do it in a way that's fair and inclusive and environmentally sound. From the early days of our republic, whether it was building the canals or the land-grant universities, we've understood that government is part of the process of making us productive, fair, and sustainable.
And what do you say to the argument, a very simple argument, response to books like yours? Sorry, can't afford it. We got a deficit here.
The precise point is that money and wealth has accumulated so much at the top that it's time for the wealthiest and richest and most powerful people in this country to play their proper role, have the civic virtues to support America's recovery.
Civic virtues. You want people to have different values than they've had, you think?
I want the people at the top to have responsibility once again. First, to follow the law, because this has been an era of corporate recklessness and scandal and illegality. And so part of civic virtue is being lawful once again. But another part of civic virtue is sharing in the responsibility of our society. And I believe that the richest and most powerful people have done very well over the last 30 years, but they have not done right for the American people, and it's time that they do.
Jeffrey D. Sachs is the author of The Price of Civilization. Thanks very much.
Oh, I'm delighted. Thank you.
And you can read an excerpt from Jeffrey Sachs' book from jeffreysachsbook at npr.org.
This month marks the centenary of the birth of sci-fi and adventure writer Jack Finney. Finney gave readers a vivid time travel fantasy in his best-selling novel Time and Again, and an enduring nightmare in his story The Body Snatchers, later renamed Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has an appreciation.
Sometimes the stories that stay with us aren't the classics or even all that polished. They're what some critics call good-bad stories. The writing may be workmanlike and the characters barely developed, but something about them is so potent that they're unforgettable. So unforgettable, they can attain the status of myth. I've long wanted to give a nod to one of these accidental mythmakers, novelist and short story writer Jack Finney. The fact that Finney would have turned 100 this month gives me an occasion. Finney started out in advertising before he became a sci-fi and suspense writer, and maybe that background accounts for the pithiness of his writing and the intensity of his images, images that bore into your brain like a parasite. Who's Jack Finney, you may ask? The two-word answer is pod people. In 1954, Finney published a serialized novel in Collier's magazine called The Body Snatchers. Later paperback editions altered the title to Invasion of the Body Snatchers. The novel was dissed for its plot inconsistencies, and the B-movie that was made of it in 1956 was largely ignored by critics. That same movie was selected in 1994 for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. Three serious remakes have been made, as well as a bunch of dopier imitations, like the 2007 direct-to-DVD opus Invasion of the Pod People, in which aliens take over the bodies of presumably heterosexual women and turn them into lesbians, perfect for viewing during October, LGBT History Month. Parodies also abound of Finney's classic tale, among them Invasion of the Muppet Snackers and Invasion of the Bunny Snatchers, starring Bugs Bunny. The term pod, used to connote a blank person, has become so much a part of everyday speech that even people who've never seen the movies or read Finney's novel know the gist of the nightmare he gave to America. It unfolds as follows. In a sunny California town that Finney calls Santa Mira, some residents have started acting so strangely, flat affect, robotic speech, that their loved ones believe them to be imposters. To his horror, the town doctor, Miles Bunnell, discovers that giant pods from outer space have been colonizing the town, replicating people's bodies and memories as they sleep. Feelings are the only human dimension the alien pods can't absorb. One by one, the human holdouts succumb to sleep and erasure, until only Miles is left to warn the rest of the country. Here's the famous ending of the original movie. Miles, played by Kevin McCarthy, is dodging traffic on a crowded highway at night, trying to warn drivers of the invasion. Ever since Finney's novel and the first film version appeared, critics have been generating theories about why this story has taken root, so to speak, in our collective imagination. The pods seem to mean all things to all critics. Lately, a post-colonialist interpretation of the pods as imperialists is popular. But given the 1950s context, the pods are most commonly seen as either symbols of the communist menace or, conversely, of McCarthyite groupthink. Finney himself always insisted that his book wasn't a Cold War novel or a metaphor for anything. "I wrote it," he said, "to entertain its readers, nothing more." Maybe. But like so many other great genre writers, James M. Cain, Shirley Jackson, even Shudder, Mickey Spillane, Finney had a knack for unearthing shallowly buried psychological anxieties. His work, and I'm thinking here also of his haunting New York City time travel novel, Time and Again, is suffused with a sense of nostalgia, loss, and powerlessness. People we love can change, Invasion of the Body Snatchers tells us, and sometimes that change is terrifying. Lovers turn inexplicably cold. Elderly parents succumb to dementia, Alzheimer's. People may look the same on the outside. They don't turn into vampires or zombies, but inside they're vacant. That's why Finney's myth of pod people really hits home. Why it's still one of the saddest scary stories ever told. When we read about or hear Miles Bennell shouting, "You're next," on that nighttime highway, we know he's right, and there's nothing any of us can do about it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org, and you can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.
The novelist Colson Whitehead won a following with stories that explore a world that's both familiar and a little skewed, or a lot. Consider the man at the center of Whitehead's new book, Zone One.
It's about a guy just trying to make it to the next day without being killed. So it's about New Yorkers.
People in New York City are the near future. It's been devastated. A mysterious plague has swept the world, turning billions of people into zombies who walk around seeking nothing except to bite and infect other people. Zone One is the story of the human survivors who were clearing the undead from Lower Manhattan. They bag and remove the zombies, which they call Skells, hoping the island can be re-inhabited. Colson Whitehead began talking with us about this book in an extended interview on Twitter some days ago, and now we continue on the radio.
The plague that's ruined the world is in remission, and we're trying to rebuild society. So our main character, Mark Spitz, is part of a team who's working downtown New York, trying to clear out the angry remaining dead from buildings. They go door to door. And Mark Spitz is trying to find his way to the next human settlement.
What made you want to destroy New York City, of all places?
New York is always destroyed. I mean, I think Giuliani, Bloomberg, they got rid of the old New York. I think each time you destroy a tenement and put up a luxury tower, you're ruining New York and making some sort of a new version of the city. And I'm walking around with my idea of what New York was 30 years ago, 20 years ago. So is everybody else. And we superimpose that ruined city over what's here now. So it's cleaned up, but we're still seeing that old shoe store, dry cleaners, that old apartment where we used to live. So any street you walk down in New York is a heap of rubble because that's sort of how we see it if we've been here a while. Mm-hmm. So it's about time for me, artistically, to take a stab at my hometown.
And that's a nice metaphor for wiping out the entire population.
Certainly. I wanted to, to cut back on the Whole Foods lines and make it easier to get a cab for my main characters. So if you get rid of 90% of the population, life gets a bit easier in the city.
Now and again, you have a description of a zombie walking through the streets of New York City, wearing his old pinstripe suit, wearing his old clothes, and it makes you think of some guy who's lost his job, who's wandering around, sitting on a park bench.
I can read that part. It's right in front of me. In this section, Omega Team, Mark Spitz is on this team of sweepers, sweeping building to building, and they're having a conference in Tribeca, and they see something coming down the street. The Skell wore a morose and deeply stained pinstripe suit with a solid crimson tie and dark brown tasseled loafers. A casualty, Mark Spitz thought. It was no longer a Skell, but a version of something that predated the anguishes. Now it was one of those laid-off or ruined businessmen who pretend to go to the office for the family's sake, spending all day on a park bench with missing slats to feed the pigeons bagel bits, his briefcase full of empty potato chip bags and flyers for massage parlors.
That does feel like current events to me.
Yeah, I mean, whether you're a zombie or a survivor, you're pretty much in Zone 1. You're going through your remembered motions. You're a ghost haunting your former life.
Did you hesitate to put out a book about zombies? Because I feel like you're trying to tell me something serious here. I really get that, but some people might not take you seriously because, well, it's a book about zombies.
Well, for me, you know, I wrote a book about elevator inspectors, and when I was writing it, I would tell my friends, and they'd say, what are you doing? You're an idiot. And I would say, yes, I am, but this is what I have to do. I didn't really have much of a choice. And I did have to give myself permission because zombies are so popular. But I think the idea is that if it's good, people read it. And so all I could do is really just salute my childhood influences and try to do the best I could in reinvigorating the genre or putting a new spin on it.
Had you grown up with apocalyptic stories, apocalyptic films, zombie films?
Well, I mean, I grew up in New York in the 70s, and so I took films like The Warriors and Escape from New York as documentaries. You know, other kids did sports. I like to hang around watching The Twilight Zone and various movies about the end of the world, whether it was Planet of the Apes, Damnation Alley. And so that's part of the city I carry with me from my childhood. And partially in doing this book, I was trying to pay homage to certain cinematic depictions of a ruined New York.
What makes an apocalyptic story succeed as opposed to one that is forgotten?
There has to be some glimmer of hope, that refuge, whether it's mythological or real, that keeps people going. You pile on the misery, and certainly I devised certain mishaps. I guess, well, frankly, I killed off a lot of my characters and did bad things to them. But there has to be some idea that you can get to a place where you can put the plague, the atomic bomb, the asteroid behind you and make a new life for yourself with the other survivors.
You told us in this Twitter interview that we did that you were in a bad mood most of the time you were writing this.
I think it helped. You know, I have an idea of how I, you know, construct work, how I make characters, situations. And then there's that hidden current of what's actually going on in your life and how it's being expressed or is kind of submerged in the writing. So, you know, over the course of 2 years, you have your own ups and downs. And I think navigating my own personal catastrophes, I think, helped the book in a certain sort of way, if that's vague enough.
Well, I was going to ask, actually, to the extent you're comfortable sharing, what personal catastrophes?
Yes, certain life changes. My father died a few months before I started the book.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Got divorced. And I think there's something about finding the next place of safety, which I think fed the book in a bit.
So have you worked out now your youthful obsession with zombies and the apocalypse and so forth?
Well, I mean, that was part of the hope. You know, some kids, some grown-ups have anxiety dreams about talking in front of a group of people and they're naked or they've forgotten all the materials for their presentation and they're unprepared. I've always had zombie anxiety dreams ever since, you know, seeing Dawn of the Dead when I was in junior high. So once a month I have some zombie dream. They're fast, they're slow. Sometimes they talk. Sometimes I'm alone. And I was definitely hoping that I would end this particular manifestation of anxiety dream by writing the book. And I was 95% successful. I had one a couple of days ago. Perhaps that's tied to publication.
Oh.
I'm not sure.
Oh. Or maybe the Twitter interview we were doing at the time may have prompted.
Thanks, Steve.
Well, Colson Whitehead, congratulations on the book. It's called Zone 1.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And you can read our complete annotated Twitter interview with Colson Whitehead. It lives online. There's a link at npr.org and also on Twitter at @NPRInskeep.
Now a new small book about a big old one. The old one is Herman Melville's Moby Dick, a book which I admit that I read for the first time just last year. It's not that I didn't know this story. As a kid, I saw the movie with Gregory Peck as Captain Ahab. Later, I read the classic comic book, And in 1962, I was actually one of the very few people to see Orson Welles' stage adaptation on Broadway with Rod Steiger. It folded so fast, after only 13 performances, that they gave away free tickets at my high school. My experience confirms what Nathaniel Philbrick writes in his slim new book, packed with insight, called Why Read Moby Dick? Even people who haven't read it know about the white whale and the obsessive Captain Ahab. The novel is much more than its plot and much more than some of the simplistic summaries of what it's supposed to be about. Nathaniel Philbrick joins us fittingly from Nantucket. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
And first, the answer to the question of your title. This book runs hundreds of pages. Life is short. Why read Moby Dick?
Read Moby Dick because I think it's as close to being our American Bible as we have. It's just full of great wisdom, but it also is just an amazing read. The level of the language is like none other, and it's a book I keep dipping into on a regular basis, almost on a daily basis.
As you describe it, Herman Melville was already a successful writer. When he wrote a novel about whaling, that would be more of an adventure story, I guess, than what it turned into. At a time when Americans actually associated adventure more with the Western frontier than with the seas. And he scrapped this book and he added all of the incredibly rich undertones and overtones that make it Moby Dick. Why? What happened?
Well, he met Nathaniel Hawthorne and read some of his stories. And it was Hawthorne's power of blackness that forever changed Melville. Melville realized what he wanted to do with this novel was entirely different from his original aim, and he completely reinvented the book and invented Ahab and made it the classic it is today.
Hawthorne is central here, but you also write about Melville's midlife encounter with the plays of Shakespeare and his ambition to outdo Shakespeare.
Yeah, well, Melville came to Shakespeare quite late, which I think proves it's best to come to books like Moby Dick and to Shakespeare after we've had some life experience. And reading Shakespeare just infused Melville's language, brought it to a level that is just unapproachable. And this combination of meeting Hawthorne but having Shakespeare as a new launching pad made for an incredible combination that made Moby Dick possible.
And you observe that it was characters like Iago and Othello, complex characters that Melville really engaged with when he read Shakespeare.
Yeah, and they're all over Moby Dick. But what Melville did is he applied it to his own experiences whaling and also with what was going on in America with the Civil War approaching. And so it made this incredible stew of influences that made it a book that really will be relevant in all times.
Speaking of stew, when you read Moby Dick, as I did fairly recently, and enjoyed it tremendously, I might say, there are chapters which will be devoted to a recipe for clam chowder or a long essay on the nature of whales, not the most current zoology that one might read, but interesting, or these incredibly detailed descriptions of how a whaling vessel actually operated. It's not just the plot outline that we're talking about here.
No, the book is full of almost chapters that are sidebars that go off on tangents that can be kind of frustrating if you're trying to follow the plot, but which lead into wormholes of just metaphysical poetry that are truly revelatory. And so reading Moby Dick, you have to have some patience, but it really is those little sidebars that take you in all sorts of directions that ultimately give it that great magisterial power.
You write about the poetry of Melville's writing, and I wonder if you could read an example of that for us now.
Yeah, this is a passage from chapter 51. It's called The Spirit Spout and picks up with the Pequod just south of St. Helena. While gliding through these latter waves in that one serene and moonlit night, when all the waves rolled by like scrolls of silver and by their soft suffusing seethings made what seemed a silvery silence, not a solitude. On such a silent night, a silvery jet was seen far in advance of the white bubbles at the bow. Lit up by the moon, it looked celestial, seemed some plumed and glittering god uprising from the sea.
Wow. When you read that, I can imagine Melville reading it aloud as he was writing it. It sounds very much like elaborate spoken prose.
It is, and you know, it's iambic pentameter at times, and the level of the writing is truly poetic, and yet he's telling this epic story, and so the combination is really one that was built for the ages.
The crew of the Pequod includes mostly whites, but blacks, Indians, Filipinos, I guess, a very famous South Sea Islander, all of them sailing for a monomaniacal, revenge-seeking captain in search of a white whale that did him dirty. You say that we're reading an allegory here of mid-19th century America.
Yeah, when Melville was working on this in 1850 and 51, all the chaos that was about to become the Civil War in a decade was in there in the society. The fugitive slave law had just been passed, and everyone knew that America was headed towards a cataclysm. And all of that is in the subtext of Moby Dick. And I think it means that in the future, whenever we will run into an imminent cataclysm, Moby Dick will once again be relevant.
It's not just that the Fugitive Slave Act was passed, as you write. Melville's father-in-law was the judge who upheld it, which meant that people in free states were complicit in slavery. They were obliged to return slaves to their owners.
Yes, and this meant that slavery wasn't just a Southern issue. Everyone was involved in it, and Melville was involved in about as close a way as you can. His father-in-law was right in the middle of it, and riots were breaking out in Boston, and Judge Shaw was the focal point of all this unrest. So all of this played into everything that's going on with Ahab and Moby Dick as it makes its way towards the white whale.
So here's the irony of Melville's Moby Dick. He'd already written books that sold well, and Moby Dick was neither a critical nor a commercial success. What happened? How did it achieve its current status?
Well, you know, Moby Dick was a great disaster when it came to the critical reception. It did not sell well. And Melville would go on to write a number of books, but would really die a virtually unknown writer. And it wasn't until the other side of World War I, with the expats in Paris and others rediscovering the book, that people began to see that contained in Moby Dick is sort of the genetic code of what's going on in America and throughout the world when it comes to people dealing with issues of authority and nature and all of this. And so the irony is that Melville died in obscurity and yet resurfaced in the 20th century to become one of the great renowned writers of our age.
Well, Nathaniel Philbrick, thanks a lot for talking with us about your, I guess we can say, your favorite book.
Yes, definitely my favorite book. Thank you.
Nathaniel Philbrick, who is the author as well of In the Heart of the Sea, has now written a book called Why Read Moby Dick?
Are you there, Satan? It's me, Madison. It's not true that your life flashes before your eyes when you die. At least not all of it.
Meet Maddie Spencer, or to be exact, Madison Desert Flower Rosa Parks Coyote Trickster Spencer, a frankly ridiculous name that she takes great pains to hide. She's 13, brainy, a little dumpy, and very, very dead.
And yes, while the dead do miss everything and everybody, they don't hang around the earth forever.
Maddie is the unlikely heroine of Chuck Palahniuk's new novel, Damned. It's a coming-of-age story whose main characters can't actually age because they are, in fact, in hell. Chuck Palahniuk joins me now from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rebecca.
So Maddie has a whole lot of names, most of them a little absurd. Tell me about her and her parents who saddled her with that moniker.
Maddie is the child of two very famous people, a movie star and a kind of internet billionaire whiz kid. And she is the result of all of the different phases of their lives that they thought would save them. And so she is the product of former hippies, former beatniks, former Scientologists, former Reaganites, former everything. And now she's dead.
You know, you are so often identified with Generation X, especially after Fight Club came out and it was hailed as sort of the voice of Gen X. And I assumed you'd grow weary of that comparison, that, you know, you'd hope your work transcends generations. But you seem to really own Gen X in this book. I mean, you make all these Breakfast Club and Judy Blume references.
Breakfast Club, Judy Blume, but also Dante's Inferno and Jonathan Swift. And more and more, it will be Charles Darwin and The Voyage of the Beagle.
So it's just allusions all over the place, not specifically to mid-80s and after-school special good feelings.
Well, to some extent, it is a mid-80s after-school special, because for Madison, for someone who's 13, these really are the classic romances of her generation. They're what maybe Casablanca was for my generation. But beyond that, it is just an overall love of books. And one of the defining themes throughout the book is Madison seeing herself as this fantastic Rebecca de Winter, over-the-top heroine, something from Daphne du Maurier or something from Jane Austen. And so much of the book is Madison's references to these other very classic gothic Jane Eyre-type books.
The Breakfast Club comes up again and again because these characters that Maddie journeys through hell with represent the same icons as represented in that movie. And, you know, it made me think about that movie differently. I never really sort of saw the no exit elements of Breakfast Club, about them all being trapped in this limbo land of detention. I think I need to go rewatch it now.
It does have that kind of ship of fools contained circumstance where it is like Sartre's No Exit, where people have to deal with their issues together. They have to expose themselves and kind of exhaust themselves. Hell is a place where people go to forget their attachments, to in a way really focus and fixate on who they were and really exhaust their stories about why they were important in the world, and then to forget those stories before moving on to something else.
I'm speaking with author Chuck Palahniuk. His new novel is Damned. It takes place in hell. The book takes place in hell. You've got all of these great details about the way hell works. I particularly loved the hierarchy of candy, that things like Milky Way bars are valuable, and then there's, you know, the wax lips and the popcorn balls that people just discard all over the floor.
Candy is the currency of hell. And if you want to get anything done, you've got to provide the certain amounts of the right kind of candy. And that Halloween serves as a function of kind of fundraising for hell. Everyone in hell goes back to Earth for a few hours every Halloween for the purpose of harvesting candy and bringing it back to hell so that they have something to spend in the coming year.
And they spend it on things like getting a better assignment in the telemarketing phone bank, because telemarketers are, of course, from hell.
They are. And that's kind of the backstory of all of this, is that I was writing the book in the year that I was taking care of my mother while she had lung cancer. And her house was just such a quiet, isolated house. And it was basically just an older woman dying of cancer and a middle-aged man writing a book about a kid in hell. And every once in a while, the phone would ring, and it would be a telemarketer. And it was kind of sweet and wonderful to have these connections to the outside world that were just about something banal like toothpicks or what brand of shampoo do you buy. And so my mother and myself would both kind of clamor to get the phone to have some connection to the outside world.
Before we get too warm and fuzzy about this, I have to say there's a lot of your description of hell that is just frankly gross. I mean, at one point, my 10-year-old son was reading over my shoulder, and I had to tell him to knock it off because it was so inappropriate. Although, I suppose in some ways, it's kind of the hell that a 10-year-old might imagine. But it's really just, ew, a lot of it.
Well, you know, a lot of that comes from when I'm on tour and I travel to cities that have a very large hotel. These hotels now have what they call an author suite, a couple. And I love that these rooms, because one wall is always covered by the autographed books of everyone who has stayed in that room. And that you know that on such and such a date, Paula Dean slept in that bed, and David Sedaris slept in that bed, and Jane Fonda slept in that bed. And so I find myself combing through these author suites, trying to find the stray hairs of Ann Coulter or the fingernail clippings of John Grisham, and pulling back the bed sheets, the mattress pad, and finding out just exactly who the bedwetter was. And just this juxtaposition of the very physical, the very sort of corrupt body parts of people next to their thoughts, their kind of most cerebral higher selves against that wall. And that juxtaposition is so fascinating.
Which makes me think hell is not quite as distant as one might imagine.
No, and all of these little aspects of ourselves that we think are resolved are still lingering somewhere, you know, waiting to be discovered.
Author Chuck Palahniuk, his new novel is Damned. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.